Furman, and many others were present. These were generally satisfied, and many of them reached, for it was a wonderful, glorious meeting, and the mighty presence of the Lord was seen and felt over all. Blessed and praised forever be his holy name, who over all giveth dominion. After this meeting, we took our leave of friends, parting in great tenderness, in the sense of the heavenly life and virtuous power of the Lord, that was his living felt amongst us, and went by water to the place where we were to take shipping. Many friends accompanying us thither and tarrying with us that night. Next day, the 21st of the third month, 1673, we set sail for England. The same day Richard Covell came on board our ship, having had his own taken from him by the Dutch. We had foul weather and contrary winds, which caused us to cast anchor often, so that we were till the 31st ere we could get past the capes of Virginia and out into the main sea. But after this we made good speed, and on the 28th of the fourth month cast anchor at King's Road, which is the harbor for Bristol. We had on our passage very high winds and tempestuous weather, which made the sea exceedingly rough, the waves rising like mountains, so that the masters and sailors wondered at it, and said they had never seen the like before. But though the wind was strong, it set for the most part with us, so that we sailed before it. And the great God who commands the winds, who is Lord of heaven, of earth, and the seas, and whose wonders are seen in the deep, stirred our course and preserved us from many imminent dangers. The same good hand of providence that went with us and carried us safely over, watched over us in our return, and brought us safely back again. Thanksgiving and praises be to his holy name forever. Many sweet and precious meetings we had on board the ship during this voyage, commonly to a week, wherein the blessed presence of the Lord did greatly refresh us, and often break in upon and tender the company. When we came into Bristol Harbor, there lay a man of war, and the pressmaster came on board to impress our men. We had a meeting at that time in the ship with the seamen before we went ashore, and the pressmaster sat down with us, stayed the meeting, and was well satisfied with it. After the meeting, I spoke to him to leave in our ship two of the men he had impressed, for he had impressed four, one of whom was a lame man. He said, "At your request, I will." We went on shore that afternoon and got to Shirehampton. We procured horses and rode to Bristol that night, where friends received us with great joy. In the evening I wrote a letter to my wife to give her notice of my landing. Footnote 224. The letter began as follows. "Dear heart, this day we came into Bristol near night from the sea. Glory to the Lord God over all forever, who was our convoy and steered our course, who is the God of the whole earth, of the seas and winds, and made the clouds his chariots beyond all words. Blessed be his name forever. He is over all in his great power and wisdom. Amen." Chapter 19, The Last Imprisonment, 1673-1678. Between this and the fair, my wife came out of the north to Bristol to me, and her son-in-law, Thomas Lower, with two of her daughters, came with her. Footnote 225. When George Fox married Margaret Fell, she had one son, George, and seven daughters as follows. Margaret, who married John Rouse. Bridget, who married John Draper. Isabel, twice married, first to William Romans and then to Abraham Morris. Sarah, who married William Meade, Penn's companion in the famous trial. Mary, who married Thomas Lower. Susanna, who married William Ingram. And Rachel, who married Daniel Abraham. Her other son-in-law, John Rouse, William Penn and his wife, and Gerard Roberts came from London, and many friends from several parts of the nation to the fair, and glorious, powerful meeting we had at that time, for the Lord's infinite power and life was over all. I passed into Wiltshire, where also we had many blessed meetings. At Slatton Ford in Wiltshire, we had a very good meeting, though we met there with much opposition from some who had set themselves against women's meetings, which I was moved of the Lord to recommend to friends for the benefit and advantage of the Church of Christ, that faithful women who were called to the belief of the truth, being made partakers of the same precious faith and heirs of the same everlasting gospel of life and salvation with the men, might in like manner come into the possession and practice of the gospel order, and therein be helpmeets unto the men in the restoration, in the service of truth, in the affairs of the church, as they are outwardly in civil or temporal things, that so all the family of God, women as well as men, might know, possess, perform, and discharge their offices and services in the house of God, whereby the poorer might be better taken care of, the younger instructed, informed, and taught in the way of God, the loose and disorderly reproved and admonished in the fear of the Lord, the clearness of persons proposing marriage more closely and strictly inquired into in the wisdom of God, and all the members of the spiritual body the church might watch over and be helpful to each other in love. Footnote 226 after Church of Christ. This is the beginning of a serious opposition to Fox's system of government, which finally grew to an open schism. It was headed by John Wilkinson and John Story. It was one of the most trying struggles of Fox's life. And footnote 227, after restoration, that is, in reclaiming those who have gone astray. After a visit at Kingston, I went to London, where I found the Baptists and Socinians, with some old apostates, grown very rude, having printed many books against us, so that I had a great travail in the Lord's power before I could get clear of that city. But blessed be the Lord, his power came over them, and all their lying, wicked, scandalous books were answered. After a visit with William Penn at the latter's home at Rickmansworth, he started on his journey north toward Swarthmore, accompanied by his wife, two of her daughters, and his son-in-law, Thomas Lower, a journey which led to more than a year's imprisonment, his last imprisonment, as it proved. At night, as I was sitting at supper, I felt I was taken, yet I said nothing then to any of it. But getting out next morning, we traveled into Worcestershire and went to John Halford's at Armscott, where we had a very large and precious meeting in his barn, the Lord's powerful presence being eminently with and amongst us. After the meeting, friends being most of them gone, as I was sitting in the parlor discoursing with some friends, Henry Parker, a justice, came to the house, and with him one Roland Haynes, a priest of Huntington in Warwickshire. This justice heard of the meeting by means of a woman friend, who, being nurse to a child of his, asked leave of her mistress to go to the meeting to see me, and she speaking of it to her husband, he and the priest plotted together to come and break it up and apprehend me. But from their sitting long at dinner, it being the day on which his child was sprinkled, they did not come till the meeting was over, and friends mostly gone. But though there was no meeting when they came, yet I, who was the person they aimed at, being in the house, Henry Parker took me and Thomas Lower for company with me, and though he had nothing to lay to our charge, sent us both to Worcester jail by a strange sort of mittimus. Being thus made prisoners without any probable appearance of being released before the quarter sessions as soon as, we got some friends to accompany my wife and our daughter into the north, and we were conveyed to Worcester. Thence, by the time I thought my wife would reach home, I wrote her the following letter. Dear heart, thou seemest to be a little grieved when I was speaking of prison, and when I was taken. Be content with the will of the Lord God. For when I was at John Rouse's at Kingston, I had a sight of my being taken prisoner. And when I was at Bray Doyley's in Oxfordshire, as I sat at supper, I saw I was taken. And I saw I had a suffering to undergo. But the Lord's power is over all. Blessed be his holy name forever. G.F. Footnote 228. Margaret Fox and her daughter were sent on under the escort of a friend, a merchant from Bristol, who Fox says, seemed to have met us providentially to assist my wife and her daughter in their journey homewards, when by our imprisonment they were deprived of our company and help. Fox had just received a message that his mother was in her last illness, and it had been his intention to part from his wife in Warwickshire and have a last visit with his aged mother. This privilege never came, for Mary Fox of Fenny Drayton died while her son was in Worcester Prison. This imprisonment began December 17, 1673. The case was brought before the session on the 21st of January, 1674. When we came in, he writes, they were stricken with paleness in their faces, and it was some time before anything was spoken, insomuch that a butcher in the hall said, what, are they afraid? Dare not the justices speak to them? There was manifestly no case against them on the mittimus, but the judge, at the suggestion of the priest, took the easy way to catch them. You, Mr. Fox, are a famous man, and all this may be true which you have said, but that me may be the better satisfied, will you take the oath of allegiance and supremacy? The usual refusal was given, followed with the penalty of premunire. During this long imprisonment, he had the promise of a pardon from the king, but he refused to get his liberty by any method, which implied that he had done wrong and needed pardon. At the next sessions in April, he got a temporary liberty, so that he went to London and attended yearly meeting, after which he returned to Worcester for a new trial, which ended in the same old way. Meantime, the strong man's constitution was yielding to the incessant strain upon it. About this time, I had a fit of sickness, which brought me very low and weak in my body, and I continued so a pretty while, insomuch that some friends began to doubt of my recovery. I seemed to myself to be amongst the graves and dead corpses, yet the invisible power did secretly support me, and conveyed refreshing strength unto me, even when I was so weak that I was almost speechless. One night, as I was lying awake upon my bed in the glory of the Lord, which was over all, it was said unto me that the Lord had a great deal more work for me to do for him before he took me to himself. After this, about October 1st, 1674, my wife went to London and spoke to the king, laying before him my long and unjust imprisonment, with the manner of my being taken and the justices proceeding against me, in tendering me the oath as a snare, whereby they had premunired me, so that I, being now his prisoner, it was in his power and at his pleasure to release me, which she desired. The king spoke kindly to her and referred her to the Lord Keeper, to whom she went, but she could not obtain what she desired, for he said the king could not release me otherwise than by a pardon, and I was not free to receive a pardon, knowing I had not done evil. If I would have been freed by a pardon, I need not have lain so long, for the king was willing to give me pardon long before, and told Thomas More that I need not scruple, being released by a pardon, for many a man that was an innocent as a child had had a pardon granted him. Yet I could not consent to have one, for I would rather have lain in prison all my days than have come out in any way dishonorable to truth. Therefore I chose to have the validity of my indictment tried before the judges. Thereupon, having first had the opinion of a counselor upon it, Thomas Corbett of London, with whom Richard Davis of Welch Pool was well acquainted, and whom he recommended to me, and habeas corpus was sent down to Worcester to bring me up once more to the King's Bench Bar for the trial of the errors in my indictment. The under-sheriff set forward with me the 4th of the 12th month. We came to London on the 8th, and on the 11th I was brought before the four judges at the King's Bench, where Counselor Corbett pleaded my cause. He started a new plea, for he told the judges that they could not imprison any man upon a premunire. Chief Justice Hale said, Mr. Corbett, you should have come sooner, at the beginning of the term, with this plea. He answered, we could not get a copy of the return and the indictment. The judge replied, you should have told us, and we would have forced them to make a return sooner. Then said Judge Wilde, Mr. Corbett, you go upon general terms. And if it be, as you say, we have committed many errors at the Old Bailey and in other courts. Corbett was positive that by law they could not imprison upon a free manure. The judge said, there is summons in the statute. Yes, said Corbett, but summons is not imprisonment, for summons is an order to a trial. Well, said the judge, we must have time to look in our books and consult the statutes. So the hearing was put off till the next day. The next day they chose rather to let this plea fall and begin with the errors of the indictment. And when they came to be opened, there were so many and gross that the judges were all of opinion that the indictment was squashed and void, and that I ought to have my liberty. There were that day several great men, lords and others, who had the oaths of allegiance and supremacy tendered to them in open court just before my trial came on, and some of my adversaries moved the judges that the oaths might be tendered again to me, telling them I was a dangerous man to be at liberty. But Chief Justice Hale said that he had indeed heard some such reports, but he had also heard many more good reports of me, and so he and the rest of the judges ordered me to be freed by proclamation. Footnote 229. This is Chief Justice Sir Matthew Hale. Thus, after I had suffered imprisonment a year and almost 2 months for nothing, I was fairly set at liberty upon a trial of the errors in my indictment, without receiving any pardon or coming under any obligation or engagement at all, and the Lord's everlasting power went over all to his glory and praise. Counselor Corbett, who pleaded for me, obtained great fame by it, for many of the lawyers came to him and told him he had brought that to light which had not been known before. As to the not imprisoning upon a free manure, and after the trial a judge said to him, you have attained a great deal of honor by pleading George Fox's cause so in court. Footnote 230. It will be noticed that Fox is set at liberty on the errors in his indictment and not on a judicial decision that is illegal to imprison on a free manure. Being at liberty, I visited friends in London, and having been very weak and not yet well recovered, I went to Kingston, and having visited friends there, returned to London, wrote a paper to the Parliament, and sent several books to them. A great book against swearing had been delivered to them a little before, the reasonableness whereof had so much influence that it was thought they would have done something towards our relief if they had sat longer. I stayed in and near London till the yearly meetings, to which friends came from most parts of the nation, and some from beyond the sea. A glorious meeting we had in the everlasting power of God. The illness I got in my imprisonment at Worcester had so much weakened me that it was long before I recovered my natural strength again, for which reason, and as many things lay upon me to write, both for public and private service, I did not stir much abroad during the time that I now stayed in the North, but when friends were not with me, I spent much time in writing for truth service. While I was at Swarthmore, I gave several books to be printed. Footnote 231. While I was at Swarthmore, I gave several books to be printed. Footnote 231. George Fox was now only 51 years old, but he was prematurely broken by the sufferings and exposures which only such an iron constitution as he possessed could have endured for 30 years. He still had 14 years to live, but from now on a decided change appears. There is no cessation of activity, but it is activity of a quieter sort. Only one important mission journey falls in these years, the visit to Holland and Germany. Henceforth, he makes his pen speak for him. Epistles and books are the main results of these 14 years. The journal grows dry and devoid of dramatic interest, and our gleanings from it will be few. He is much at Swarthmore or at Kingston, near London, where Margaret Rouse, the daughter of his wife, lived. This